It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, groundhogs around the country have predicted an early spring today. We'll talk to a human weather expert about that prediction, the winter storm hitting Wisconsin now, and about the El Nino outlook for the rest of the winter.
First, a nonprofit group in Madison is looking to bring yoga into classrooms to help teachers and students perform better.
The organization is called Breathe for Change. It was named one of the Bright Ideas for 2016 in the Capital Times. The program will certify 80 state teachers as wellness instructors by the end of the year, which leaders say could help reduce burnout and increase engagement.
Here to tell us more about this program idea is Alana Nankin, founder and CEO of Breathe for Change. Alana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So how did the Breathe for Change program get started?
Well, so I'll take you back to when I was a pre-K teacher, is kind of where it all began. So in 2009, I started teaching pre-K in a Spanish dual immersion school. And as a first-year teacher, found myself, like many teachers, very stressed, overworked, and overwhelmed. And that's when I found practices such as yoga and mindfulness and started integrating them into my life and found incredible benefits for my own well-being. And then also started using these practices with my young students and saw just absolute transformations in my classroom and in their ability to learn. And then in 2012, I came to the University of Wisconsin to pursue my PhD in curriculum and instruction. And for the last 3 years, have been a teacher educator in the teacher education program. So I've had the amazing opportunity to teach courses to pre-service teachers who are then going to go into the classroom and change kids' lives. And last year, my students found out that I was a yoga instructor and thought it was pretty cool and asked if they could rent out space in the student union for me to teach them yoga, meditation, mindfulness practices. And I started doing that, and without me even telling them to bring it to schools, they naturally started implementing these practices with kids all over the Madison schools and kept coming back to me saying, "Ilana, it's working." These, you know, kids who had a lot of trouble either focusing or were experiencing trauma are really improving their emotional outcomes. And they said, "Train us." And at the same time, this last year, I was following 8 teachers who I had taught for 2 years in the teacher ed program into their first year of teaching and created a community to support them. And it was so clear that within even the first few months of their teaching, they too, just like I was, became so stressed, so overwhelmed, and yet didn't necessarily have the tools to take care of themselves so that they can then, of course, take care of our kids. And so seeing the ripple effect of these practices really positively positively affecting kids and these teachers all over, and then seeing at the same time, teachers just so stressed and not have the tools to take care of themselves, I was like, okay, I need to do something about this. And then I started Breathe for Change.
So it sounds like it's addressing the needs of teachers, but it also has a component for students so that they can take part of these same practices. So how do you go about implementing that? I mean, teachers have so much on their plates right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the reason for the stress.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of requirements. They have to get a lot of instruction time in the classroom. How do you make time for yet one more thing, even if it's a positive thing?
Well, so the way that we have structured our programming for teachers is we do a 200-hour wellness and yoga teacher training for educators. It's the only one in the world that's ever been designed specifically for teachers. And that takes place over the summer in a very intensive 16-day training. And so, you know, teachers have time off, so that works. And we did the first one last summer. 34 educators from across the country came to Madison to participate, and it was one of the most transformational experiences for sure of my life, and I know for everyone who went through it. And so we train teachers to basically become experts of these practices, and then we also have a school-wide wellness program that supports these teacher leaders, or we call them our school wellness champions, in implementing these practices not only into their own classrooms, but supporting them in creating the space to teach the other teachers at the school, as well as their students and their entire school communities.
We're talking with Alana Nankin right now. She's telling us about how yoga and mindfulness can benefit Wisconsin's classrooms, the teachers and the students, and she's the founder and CEO of Breathe for Change. And you've been mentioning the practices. Can you walk us through what some of them might be for teachers in the classroom?
Absolutely. So it's obvious that teachers already are at their final capacity in terms of, you know, the curriculum that they have to implement. And so this is not in place of math or in place of literacy by any means. It's to support what they're already doing. So, for example, we teach teachers little techniques that they can use in transition to transition kids from one subject to the next, something like a little breathing technique or something to focus them in. We also have a bunch of techniques that teachers can use in community circles to build classroom community and the culture and to really improve and deepen relationships between students and also teachers and families and whatnot. We have a lot of times, especially with students who are experiencing trauma or have really challenging lives, there have higher levels of stress and anxiety, which negatively affect their academic outcomes, of course. And so what we believe is that if we utilize these techniques to minimize the stress and the anxiety that they're feeling and to give them the tools to be able to regulate their emotions on their own, then the academic outcomes are going to be so much better. And so we teach teachers those techniques tons. I mean, they get everything from little meditations to mindfulness activities to community building exercises that they can implement in any way across the school day, whenever it feels like the right moment that their kids need that.
Now, one of the things that seems unique is that this is specifically geared to a teacher's mm-hmm. life and the things that happen within a classroom. I mean, I've heard of mindfulness exercises being brought in and the kids participating, but what seems unique is that they're being integrated as part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. So, I mean, for example, let's say a teacher has to teach young children the concept of prediction, you know? So they're reading a story and they ask children, what do you predict is going to happen next? And in our case, we would think, wait, well, maybe if you took them through a visualization in this literacy activity and you taught them or you had kids close their eyes and think about what's happened in the story so far and visualize that and then visualize what do you think is going to happen next and then have them, you know, see that and open their eyes and then it engages such a deeper learning experience where they're still teaching and getting across the same concepts, but they're using these wellness and techniques that research shows has incredible benefits to students' learning and their overall well-being to help them get to the learning outcomes that they're already trying to do.
Is this a hard sell in schools? I know you brought this to Madison. Mm-hmm. You're still expanding in Wisconsin in general, and you also have some roots in the Bay Area, so you're doing things there. Are people ready to add this on and to bring this to schools and to kids, or is this something that you have to convince them on?
So it has been mind-boggling it's not even just easy. It's the principals and the teachers and superintendents want this. They're coming to us. They're seeking it out. After the training, we hadn't even created the school-wide wellness program yet, but it was because teachers and then principals were coming to our team saying, we want this in our schools. How do we do it? That we created this wellness program. And what we did was we met with principals of the teachers that went through our program and found every single conversation that we had was, it seemed like a yes. And the question is how can we do it? And now, so we're in 9 schools total now, and the principals have all been and the school leadership and all of the teachers at the school have been just so positive and so excited about what they're seeing. And we've been doing 2-hour professional developments that start with transformation of self. Then the second one moves into transformation of teaching, which is really about the integration of the practices into the classroom. And then transformation of school community, which is really about sharing these techniques with the entire school community, including the families. And we've just seen that teachers are coming to us and saying things like, I've never felt this calm in 25 years of school, or this has absolutely transformed my teaching.
I know the Breathe for Change is pretty new. Do you have any data about whether this is helping teachers stay in the profession?
So that's actually one thing that we are really excited about doing over time. Obviously, it's challenging to have those identifiable results within 1 year, but we're definitely tracking it. What we are seeing is, with the qualitative research that we're conducting, is that teachers... It's even mine in my dissertation research who said, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Like, I might be one to leave the classroom, and I never thought I would be that way, are saying, this has fundamentally transformed my life, and now I'm committed, and I have the tools to be able to deal with the stresses that I couldn't previously deal with. So we know from the teachers' experiences and their stories that, yes, it is having the outcomes that will have those significant quantitative outcomes that we want to see in terms of teacher burnout and retention. So it's very exciting.
Alana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was education expert Alana Nankin talking about an effort to bring yoga to the classroom to improve our schools for students and teachers.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear about a Wisconsin effort to boost understanding of African-American history.
First, happy Groundhog Day. In case you missed the news, Punxsutawney Phil did not see his shadow this morning. Neither did Jimmy the Groundhog in Sun Prairie. That means they are predicting an early spring.
It's ironic because a big winter storm is hitting most of Wisconsin today. And here to break down the details of the storm and to give an outlook for the rest of the winter is Jeff Last. He's a warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Jeff, what are conditions like on the ground in Green Bay right now?
Well, the heavy band of snow has moved north and east of the Green Bay area. So we have a light snow and some snow pellets falling. We picked up a quick 4 to 5 inches of snow in the area in only about 4 hours. So it came down pretty fast when it started just after lunchtime.
So you said it's moved on a bit north and east there, but does that mean we're done, Wisconsin is done, or is this one of those storms with a 1-2 punch?
Yeah, there's definitely a 1-2, perhaps even a little 3 punch. The first one, you know, has gone through, I know, in Madison earlier today and through central northeast Wisconsin this afternoon. There are areas of moderate to heavy snow now in far northeast Wisconsin and in the far northwest. And across much of the rest of the area, just some lighter snow showers or even rain showers around Milwaukee. The main area of low pressure, though, is still over parts of Missouri and in northeast Kansas, and that'll be moving in and anticipated to produce a second round of some precipitation overnight. Again, it'll be mainly snow across north and central and a mix in the far southeast. And then maybe a third area of snow, which we're kind of watching, that could develop tomorrow, midday tomorrow, and produce an inch or two of snow in parts of central and eastern Wisconsin.
All right. So the Groundhog Day blizzard or storm is not over yet. I guess it's not a blizzard, right? We officially know that this does not qualify as a blizzard, does it?
No, it really doesn't. Although the winds haven't picked up yet, and I think overnight they will pick up a bit more. But even then, I don't anticipate too much in the way of blizzard conditions, which has a strict definition of 3 hours of wind gusts over 35 miles an hour and frequent visibility near zero. We're not going to have that. I suppose in a few isolated locations in the rural parts of Wisconsin, you may see that. But overall, nothing like what they're seeing in parts of Nebraska and South Dakota this afternoon.
Well, as an armchair weather watcher, I'm interested in the weather. It seemed unusual to me that this storm was so hard to predict. I don't think I can remember seeing so many meteorologists saying, well, we don't really know what's going to happen. The forecasts are different and they could change. It seemed like we didn't know right until about the storm hit. Why was that?
Well, that's not too uncommon, actually. We knew there was going to be a big storm in the Midwest. We knew that even early last week. That something big would hit early this week, in particular Tuesday, Wednesday time frame. The question, as often is the case here, is the details. Where is that low going to track? Because that will, of course, tell us where that rain snow line will end up. And this time, that rain snow line was very close to the big cities in Wisconsin, Madison and Milwaukee. So you heard a lot more about it than perhaps you would if that rain snow line was setting up in northern Wisconsin. We probably wouldn't be talking about that. So when the big cities are affected, that's when we tend to remember those events.
Are meteorologists getting more cautious, do you think, about putting projected snow totals or weather out there before the models are clear these days?
I don't know if they're more careful, but certainly with social media, we do have to use some care when putting out forecasts before we have all of the available information. Because if you put out just a map with a bunch of high totals off of one computer model run or simulation, people will take that. And by people, I mean the general public, they'll take that as if that is the actual forecast, when in fact it's just one possible scenario. And I think in general people don't understand all the different computer models that we use to put together a forecast. And those models are simulations of how the atmosphere is going to react when the jet stream is producing these storms. And so I think we certainly are more cautious in how we distribute that information so that people don't misconstrue what it is we're trying to tell them.
We're talking with Jeff Lass from the National Weather Service in Green Bay, talking about the winter weather we're getting on this Groundhog Day and also looking ahead to what we might expect for spring, maybe an early spring if you believe the groundhog, and what El Nino might have to do with all of this too. So talking Groundhog Day, the prediction is for an early spring. The groundhogs in Sun Prairie and in Pennsylvania, they did not see their shadows for telling an early spring. Are you on board with that?
Well, not because the groundhog is saying anything, but we are in that El Nino pattern. We've been talking about that for months now, and our winter so far across the state is pretty typical of an El Nino-type winter in Wisconsin. That means generally milder temperatures overall, less cold intrusions from the Arctic, and usually less snowfall than normal. And in general, that's the way it's been over much of the state. I would anticipate that trend to continue, although we are going to see some pretty cold air as we get into next week. Once this low-pressure system moves through, that's going to help to build a cold air mass that will drive south into Wisconsin sometime early or mid next week. But, that aside, I think overall, over the next 6 or 8 weeks, temperatures will probably end up being a bit milder than normal as we look into the future.
How long does the effect of El Nino linger?
Well, that's a good question. It does linger into the spring and perhaps a bit into summer. Not so much, though, in the Midwest. There's less of a correlation with respect to Midwest weather and El Nino as we get into the warm season. The correlation between El Nino and Midwest weather is stronger in the winter. I think the strong El Nino, which is starting to weaken a bit now, will cause that lingering mild conditions to continue into late winter and early spring. And after that, it's a little more difficult to use El Nino as a predictor for Wisconsin warm season weather.
Is there any kind of model or marker that you could look at to tell us what kind of summer we might expect if we're looking forward to summer?
Well, There's a special branch of the National Weather Service called the Climate Prediction Center, which looks at long-term models and global weather conditions. Their latest outlook for the June, July, August 3-month period is calling for temperatures to be near or above normal, at least a greater than 50-50 chance of temperatures near or above normal for that 3-month period. So there is some indication that the mild weather will continue.
So people who love the winter were a little bummed out that this storm, at least in a lot of places, was not quite as intense as we were thinking it might be early on. As a meteorologist, do you get disappointed when these big storms don't deliver?
I think a lot of the meteorologists that I work with and that I know, they became interested in meteorology because of the big storms, whether it's summertime thunderstorms or the snowstorms in the winter, and that certainly was the case with me. So, yes, I think there probably is some disappointment when a storm underperforms or doesn't track exactly as we thought, especially, you know, these winter storms. But once the snow stops, I'm usually glad if it's a bit lighter than forecast because it's less for me to shovel and snow blow. And I think a lot of people probably think the same thing.
Well, Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
That is Jeff Last, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Green Bay. He joined us there for a breakdown of the winter weather hitting Wisconsin and a look at the weather for the rest of the winter.
So were you disappointed by the, you know, because last week we saw that chart he was talking about, the misleading chart, it turned out, that said lots. Were you hoping for a big one like that?
I was a little disappointed. There is something kind of special about it, right? We all kind of band together. We go to the grocery store and buy popcorn. So, yeah.
Just popcorn? That's you heard the popcorn.
Bread,
before the
milk,
snow.
And popcorn.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Forget the milk. Forget the bread. It's all about the popcorn. Well, coming up, our guest says we need to learn more about African-American history to reduce racial tensions in our present and future. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The news is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at last night's Iowa caucus and what it could mean for the rest of the 2016 presidential race.
First, February is African American History Month, a month when community events, TV programs, and other campaigns raise awareness of the contributions of African Americans to the United States.
In December 2014, Reverend Alex G. wrote a piece that was published in the Capital Times about his experiences with racism and discrimination in Madison. The Justified Anger Coalition took its name from his essay, and it's been working on finding solutions to racial disparities in the greater Madison area.
One current project of the Justified Anger Coalition is an 8-week course on African American history that's open to the public and starts next Tuesday, February 9th.
Joining us now to talk about the course and why it might be needed is Reverend Alex G. He's pastor of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison and the founder and CEO of the Nehemiah Corporation. He's also the chair of the Justified Anger Coalition. Reverend G., welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, why is offering a course like this, a review, an update on African-American history, a priority for the Justified Anger Coalition?
Well, it's because I feel that we've done a lot of work in sensitizing people to issues of diversity. But if we're going to move ahead together, it's important to understand how we've gotten to this particular point. History shows some of the systemic realities that have created some of the disparity that we have. And if we just change laws but not attitudes and don't look at history together so as to prepare us to not repeat it, it means that we've got to take a new look at history in order to really invest in white residents who want to be allies and partners with us in dismantling racism.
And are those potential white allies kind of the target audience for this course?
Yes. Yes, they are.
And you've said elsewhere that one thing you're not trying to do is create a sense of white guilt in the class. So what do you mean by that? How do you avoid that?
Well, when I talk to many of my white colleagues, and we have discussions about diversity day or training, it's always met with the deal with a great sense of guilt. Okay, all right, we're going to be told all the things we've done wrong and who we've stolen land from and who we've committed genocide against and who we've enslaved. And the whole purpose of this is not to make people feel bad about themselves, but most white Americans have not studied African American history being overlaid or being taught against just general U.S. history. So I asked a colleague who teaches in the history department if he would help me in designing this course, because usually black history is something that the black students learn or maybe a few students may check it out in schools, but the general public has learned a U.S. history that is void of African Americans' contributions and activities. And so we just feel that as we're moving ahead with the work of Justified Anger, we have many good-willed individuals who want to be part of the solution, but they don't fully understand the problem. They understand that it rears its head and its ugly inequities, but don't have a clue as to how these inequities came to be, how they've been sustained, and how they've become embedded in society and systems. And so if people want to really help us dismantle systems and instances of racism, they've got to really have a working knowledge of how we got here. And so I felt that if we were to have a 7-week course where we work on personal transformation and understanding systemic and historic racism, what happened in U.S. that created a breeding ground for slave system, what was going on, how that was perpetuated, and how residual effects of that might still be around, all of that helps people to be on the same playing field and on the same page with us as we look at moving the discussion of unity ahead.
And when I think of American history and how it approaches African-American history, that slavery will come up, and then that's done in the Civil War. And then the Civil Rights Movement in the late 50s and early 1960s, those are the things that seem maybe to get taught, if anything does. How are you looking to flesh it out beyond those two big name, more higher profile historical chapters?
Sure. I think what we want to do is to talk about, typically we discuss those things as just mere historical facts. We don't really get into, in your general U.S. history, we don't really get into what the mindset was of individuals who felt that it was spiritually fortuitous, economically viable, and politically okay to enslave people's minds and their bodies and their dreams and their families. So we just say slavery happened like an iceberg melted. You know, there was no real impetus to it. It's just something that just happened. It just fell on American soil. So we actually talk about what was going on. And we'll begin by talking a bit about what was happening in Africa before slavery, because many people have no idea of what people of African descent did, contributed, or were involved in prior to slavery. So for most people, they think that's just where black civilization began. And when we just jump to civil rights, we don't really talk about what the impetus of that was, that slavery was a culture of resistance, that civil rights was the act of reclaiming rights, inalienable rights, given to black Americans. And, you know, things that talked about, you know, those rights in the 13th, 14th Amendment, you know, inside the Constitution. So it wasn't really black people trying to get rights. Black people were given the right to vote 150 years ago. Black people were electing black people into offices during Reconstruction. 16 black men were in Congress at the turn of the 20th century. And so people see the civil rights as something new, but it was really the reclamation of something, some rights that we were given but had been denied, legally had been given through the Constitution. So connecting those dots, looking at those systems, so that people understand what we mean when we say systemic issues. Because for some people, that's a buzzword. They don't really know what it means. My family came here and we worked out of poverty. Why can't you and your community? So not understanding the systemic realities that continues to perpetuate racial differences and inequities. And so we want to give people a great sense of the role that those thoughts, those processes, and those systems played in shaping American culture, politics, and economics. And we think that that empowers people to have a better sense of what we're up against today. Because if we think that we're going to fix our issues by just having more mentors and tutors and not understanding that we need white allies to not only tutor and mentor black children, but to be knowledgeable enough to help their white children understand what's happening in the world so that hopefully down the road my children and your children will work together for a better solution, that involves understanding how we got here. Otherwise, we will never have a chance of working together to get out of here.
Talking to Reverend Alex G. about an effort to educate people on African-American history. Reverend G., we've talked about this in the past, the idea that, say, with something like police and African-American relations, it keeps coming as a surprise in some ways. Oh, Rodney King or the Ferguson, Missouri shooting and the reaction to that. Is that part of your hope that these don't get seen as isolated events but part of an ongoing story, an ongoing narrative?
Definitely. Definitely. And what we mean by saying that we're not going after white guilt is that we want to present history. We're not telling people you did this, your grandparents did this. We're just saying This is what happened. Let's look at historical documents. Let's look at literature. Let's look at political rulings. And we will find that what's happening in Madison and the country today is not so unrelated. The dots have been connected in the minds of people of color, but not necessarily in the minds and the hearts of our white colleagues. And so we're hoping that history connects the dots so that people understand the fear and the consternation that's raised in the hearts of black people and others when things like police brutality, in case of police brutality, when they take place, it's important to understand the other string of events historically that this reawakens.
I was going to say, are we also going to meet characters from history? I mean, if we could think of Dr. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, maybe Frederick Douglass, is part of the effort of this class to highlight other people, the people who don't make it into the mainstream history books.
It is a part of that, but I think more importantly, it's important to understand that these were figureheads who had an entire team of people around them making it work. And for individuals like myself, it alleviates some of the pressure because when you think that one person can create a movement, we miss the fact that there were so many other people behind the scenes, and in many cases of different ethnic backgrounds, really making what Rosa Parks, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., others do, viable. And so yes, we will bring to light other people who have not been seen in a historical famous light, but we will talk about the plethora of unnamed faces of people who really were the life of the civil rights movement, so that we can remind people who are coming to our course, it takes all of us together to make this work, and not just whites on the sidelines watching blacks work.
We're talking to Reverend Alex G. about the public course on African American history that the Justified Anger Coalition is offering starting next Tuesday.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have a good understanding of African American history, or was it a neglected subject when you went to school? What would you like to know about African American history? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Reverend Alex G., pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison. And we're talking about the Justified Anger Coalition's public course on African American history that starts next week and runs through March.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you studied African American history? Do you think we need to know more about it than we do? Has it helped you understand current issues of race and inequality in a different way? And who are the African Americans in history or today that inspire you? Call 800-642-1234. Oh, and if there were a class like this in your neck of the woods, would you want to attend? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers with Brent in Milwaukee. Brent, hi.
Hello there. Reverend G., I want to thank you for putting this out there, and I would actually, like was just said on the radio, is there anything like this planned for the Milwaukee area?
You know what? That is a great, great question. Right now, we don't, but I would love to take, if you're making this as a suggestion, I would love to take it forward, because I think we need more of it. I think people are interested in learning what they weren't taught. And again, the beauty of this is, it's a U.S. history professor that's teaching it. It's a white gentleman. He's not a part of our congregation. He's an academician. And so he's not presenting propaganda as much as this is part of his research. And I think we do need to find ways to get this out to other parts of our state. So to answer your question, no, but I think it's something we really should be considering.
Brent, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to John in Racine. John, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to very much agree with your guest and share my own experience. As an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, I had an excellent professor, Goldstein, who assigned five different readings of black history. I remember two of them. One was called Black Rage by Greer and Cobbs, and the other was A Mind of the South by, I believe it was Cash. And they just gave me a real good historical perspective, as well as dealing with the psychology of being African American in the United States today, that has helped me to be more understanding of some of the events in the last couple of years and reactions of African Americans to some of the brutality we've seen. And And so it has given me, I think, a good perspective on things.
John, thanks a lot for that call. And Reverend G, is that a part of your hope here, not just this class that Justified Anger is working on, but that in education at whatever level that we see more attention to the African-American part of American history?
Yes, I think it's very important because, again, our premise is that this is U.S. history. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I one of the things we want to teach some of the white participants, particularly white women, is that during some of the lunch counter sit-ins, white students from in North Carolina, white female students, actually sat with black protesters. And after they did that for a while, some of the white male students came as well. But it had become a co-ed sit-in that eventually spread to about several cities and several states. That was the beginning of the desegregation of the lunch counters. So there are many whites who only think of black history as something that promotes guilt or shame, not understanding that there are very pivotal points where their partnership was key. The other part of it is, it's important to understand blacks voted. We elected people to key positions in southern states, and resistance from the predominant culture stepped in and issued things like poll tax and literacy tests and things that hindered blacks from voting because it garnered too much power. So it's important for people to understand that whatever lens through which we see black culture in the communities today, it did not always look like that. And I want people to be able to look at this historically and say, what was put in place when there were black politicians being elected 100 years ago, and why is that a rarity today? What happened? What was put in place that stopped this? And I think it will cause people to want to read more and learn more to understand that there are some real systemic issues that are there, but if we work together and identify them and work against them, we can begin to see more equality for everyone. I hope that it sparks hope in people's hearts.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Natalie in Mequonago. Natalie, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
What do you think?
This is very timely for me, and I'll try to be succinct. I'm dealing with something with my oldest daughter. I have two biracial daughters, and there's some tweets. She had posted something about being kind of discouraged that disappointed that her school, they don't close the schools for Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in this district, barely touching on Black History Month. And then she got a really, really disturbing tweet from someone she knows. It had the N-word in it. And I'm addressing it with the school. But my question is, I would like to know where to start because it's a very insulated feeling education, a lack of any kind of awareness or interest in helping these kids be more aware of other cultures, other anything other than just the white world.
Natalie, thanks for the call, and we're almost out of time. Reverend G, a big question there, but your thoughts on hearing that?
I say that she's on the right page. I think that she should really bring colleagues, either from work or from her faith community, to sit down with the board and leaders and say, this is not just helpful to my daughter who's biracial, but this is U.S. history, and we need to empower other students to be better prepared to become world leaders. And if our students that we're training in our district don't understand cultures that live in this community, how do they become leaders in a more cosmopolitan world? So I would say to Natalie, bring friends, talk with folks, but present it as a way of helping all students and not just African-American students, because this is so important for our students to understand our country and its history.
Reverend G, very briefly, I know this is the first round of this class. Are you hoping to do more and, as we heard from a caller earlier, help export this to other towns around the state?
I would love to do that. Yes, we would love to take it to other towns around the state. And our registration is still open until tomorrow. So if people follow us on Twitter or will go to the Nehemiah website, they could click the Justified Anger button and still register for the class. I think we've got 20 more slots before we close off at 150.
Reverend G, thanks a lot for spending the time with us today.
Thank you.
That was Alex G., pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison and founder and CEO of Nehemiah. He spoke with us about the Justified Anger Coalition's new public African-American history class.
Be sure to check out the Central Time Facebook page where we have a link to a New York Times archive of previously unpublished images from African-American history. They'll be updating that link throughout the month.
People in more than 22,000 Wisconsin homes may be consuming unsafe levels of lead in their drinking water. In the second half of our series looking at the issue, Bridget Bowden reports testing for lead can be difficult and the toxic metal often goes completely undetected.
In 2014, nearly 4,000 Wisconsin children were found to have elevated blood lead levels, many of them in Milwaukee. Ramona Jensen is a lead liaison at the Social Development Commission. She helps find and eliminate lead hazards in the city. The motivation for her work is personal. She believes she and her son were both lead poisoned from exposure to lead paint.
Lead causes brain damage. Lead causes cognitive problems, developmental problems. It has been linked with ADHD. It causes impulsive behavior. It causes aggressive behavior. And then a host of health problems that go on into adulthood.
But only about 20% of Wisconsin's young children are even tested for blood lead each year. It's a mandatory test for kids covered by Badger Care, but most kids with private insurance aren't tested. Officials say most lead poisoning comes from old paint or soil, but Jensen says drinking water is a potential source that often goes unnoticed.
You can buy a little kit to put tape jumps in and send it off to a lab and they'll tell you. You can't do that with water. Water, it's not just a one-time, go turn your faucet on, let me take that. No, that's not how it works. It's a complicated procedure that the occupants have to do. And they have to do it in a certain time, in a certain way, at a certain, you know, time apart. And I think it's too complicated for the average person to just say, go do this.
Beginning in 2001, the city of Madison replaced all lead service lines that connected buildings to the municipal water supply. But in other parts of the state, that's not the case. The EPA loosely estimates that in Wisconsin, 176,000 of these pipes are made of lead. But Mark Edwards, an engineering professor who led the study of Flint, Michigan's spike in drinking water lead, thinks that number is probably higher because of lax testing requirements.
Unfortunately, over the years, water companies have learned how to sample in areas of the cities that have lower lead in water, even if they do have lead pipe.
The EPA's regulation for lead in public drinking water is called the Lead and Copper Rule. It's supposed to ensure that Americans are protected from drinking dangerous levels of the highly toxic heavy metal. But in reality, the rule only requires a fraction of Wisconsin homes on known lead service lines to be tested. Public water systems serving more than 100,000 customers have to test 100 households per round of monitoring. Those that serve fewer than 100 customers only have to sample 5. And Edwards says a single test won't always give you accurate results.
We have investigated homes of lead poisoned children where about 20 samples of lead in water have been collected, and 18 of those will look perfectly fine, and then sample 19 and 20 will have a piece of lead in it. Could be hazardous waste levels of lead in that glass of drinking water. And if a child were to consume it, it'd be the same as eating about 10 dime-sized lead paint chips.
For Edwards, acknowledging that aging lead pipes are a public health concern is the first step to solving the problem.
You know, those memories are short. The pipes are very long-lived. They're going to be there 1,000 years unless we do something about it.
For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Bridget Bowden.
If you missed the first part of the series looking at lead contamination, it's available at WPR.org. This story was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
Coming up, we'll take a look at last night's Iowa caucus results. One close race, one big surprise on the other side. We'll be joined by NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.